Hi, I'm Lori. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lori.
I take my watch off, but it's part of my outfit. Actually, I need two. You know, I love the sound of my own voice. I always have, and it's one of my character defects. I'm working on it. I'll keep an eye on what time it is, and when I see you start yawning, I'll know we're done. First of all, before we get going, I want to thank the committee. Everybody has been fabulous and wonderful. I mean, Carrie and I go to conferences all over the United States. We meet a lot of people, and I really, I know you think I suck up to all of you, but I really don't. Because I work an honest program, and I'm just not that nice. So, but you guys are. You really are. I'm sorry I didn't get to hear the Friday night speaker. We didn't get in until late. I have to have jobs now in sobriety. And so it's not like the old days when I can roll in and roll out. But this morning, these are the first two that I met, and we had a blast. I think we bonded right away, and I had them getting on the internet and watching silly things and learning about honey badgers, and we'll talk about that later. So, because honey badgers don't give a shit. But when we got to our room last night, Carrie and I walk into this, and I'm, wow, you know what? Before I got sober, that place was bigger than most places I lived, you know, and much nicer and cleaner. I'm like, wow, this is bigger than any one-bedroom apartment I've ever had. And there was these lovely bags on the table, and I thought it was a bridal shower because there was linens, and there was dishes, and there was, you know, clothing. I mean, I got a shirt, a beach towel, and a coffee cup. And it was filled with fruits and chocolates, which you guys probably don't know. I'm allergic to chocolate. Well, I'm not really allergic, but whenever I eat it, I break out with a big fat ass. So I try to avoid it. So here's Carrie and I last night, and we're tired, and we've worked, and we're eating chocolates on the couch. And I'm saying, I don't think you'll like these. These are dark chocolate, honey. You don't like dark chocolate. She does, and so I had to share. And it's kind of like my drugs in the old days. I like sharing yours, not mine. But anyway, we were very touched, and we really are very honored. It's always an honor and a privilege to share my experience, strength, and hope at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember when I was new and people would say that, I thought it sounded so trite. But it really is true. And I was sharing with Brian before I got up here that, you know, this is a very humbling experience for a person who by nature is not very humble. I came into these rooms very arrogant on the outside. And I was sharing with somebody last night. I walked in and some of the women, they would do this. And I thought, woo, they're glad to see me. No, it was the tornado. Here she comes. She's ripping through the room. And I found that out later. They made bets whether or not I would make it. And because I got a know-it-all tag in here. I didn't have quite the guts to put it on because I thought you'd think I'd still think that way today. But really, it was a reminder of how when I got here, I was a know-it-all. And today, thank God, I'm teachable. You know, I've been around long enough, and today I'm teachable. I was born in Flint, Michigan, and everything went really, really well for the first 3 years. And then it went south really quick. I lived in a neighborhood where it was it's not a very big town, and much of my family lived on the same block or within a few blocks. And so you thought when your kids went out to play that you were safe. You know, your family was all around. And, well, the danger was in my family, not outside it. So, the people that weren't related to me were really safe to be around, but my family wasn't. And there was a great uncle that lived up the street, and he began molesting me before my memory begins. And so it was very dangerous to go to that end of the street. And then a few years later, a boy up the other way began molesting me, and it was very dangerous to go up there. So at a very young age, I had to try to figure out how to manipulate my way around the streets, you know, so that I would be okay. It was very scary when I would go out to ride my bike or go to a family member's house because I just didn't know what was going to happen. And so my parents split up when I was 6 years old, and I thought because everybody found out what had happened to me, there was this big hoopla. We were pulling out of the family. That was obviously my fault. My parents were divorcing. That's obviously my fault. So by the time I was 8 years old, I needed a drink. And it was a summer morning, and my brother, who is four, this, I can't see. I can't see one person, and you're the person that's snickering. I got to make sure that. You're the one I've got to focus on. Thank you. Now I can see Don. Okay, I'm better now. You had this big stick. You were happy about it, but I wasn't. You know, Ooh, that's that little noise going on. We need to stop that. That's a vibration of this sitting on the. Yeah, it's not good. I normally don't like the shape of this, but microphones, I love this. It's the only time that gets this close to my mouth is when something's shaking. So, I so carry on when I get nervous, and I'm telling you I am right now. So where was I? I'm still six. Hopefully I'll get sober because I'm 49. We got a long way to go. Let's settle down. Wait a minute, I'm eight. I'm starting to drink. So my brother began stealing beers at a very young age, like 3 or 4 years old. And I caught him one day. I come out in the living room, and it was so cute. He was sitting there with his legs crossed. He had a magazine on his lap upside down because he couldn't even read yet. And he was blowing into a cigarette. He somehow managed to get lit. And somebody had left a partial beer from the night before, and he was drinking it. And I thought it was the cutest thing I'd ever seen in the world. So I woke my mother up, and I brought her out. And I'm like, isn't that so cute? And she's like, no, honey, it's really not. So when I was 8 years old, he got up one day, and he got a can of beer out of the fridge. And he opened it. Now, here's why I'm in AA and not in Al-Anon. If I were going to qualify for Al-Anon, I would have taken the beer out of his hand, I would have dumped it, I would have hid the can and covered the whole thing up. I did want to cover the whole thing up. But instead, I took the beer out of his hand and I scolded him because he's going to get us in trouble if Mom knew that he was taking this beer. But instead of dumping it and hiding the can, I got a coffee cup down out of the cupboard. I poured it in there and I drank it. I think I got a second. I'm not sure. But it was probably 7 o'clock in the morning. My mother was still asleep. And it's the time of day where the kids own the neighborhood. All the parents are asleep and we're all up and outside. And I was out on the front yard and I've got my coffee cup and I've got my beer and I've got a buzz. And all the kids in the neighborhood are coming over to my yard, and I learned some very important things that day, that I was funny, that I was okay in my own skin, and I wasn't that little girl that was being abused. And the reason that I share what happened to me is because I know a lot of times it's very hard for me to stand up and talk about being abused like that. It is. And I remember the first time I shared it in a meeting, and I remember women and men coming up to me and saying, I'm so glad that you were brave enough to share that, because I drank around that for a lot of years. Now, being molested didn't make me an alcoholic. Being a lesbian didn't make me an alcoholic. None of these things. I believe for me, and everything I say up here is not the opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the opinion of Lori B. But what it did was it opened up that low self-esteem, that no self-worth, and that no self-love. So by 8 years old, I had none of that. So that first drink, and I was popular, and the older kids were in my yard, and they thought I was funny, and they wanted to be around me. It was golden. It was absolutely golden. So I'm holding court in my front yard, and we're laughing, and we're having a good time. I'm having a little drink. My mother comes out there, and the party's over. She does not find me cute no more than she found my little brother cute. So she brings me in the house. I throw up all over the bathroom, and paradise is over. Now, I'm telling you, I don't like throwing up. That was not enjoyable. And so it took me another 9 years to figure out how to get this drug into my body and not give it back, you know? Because this is how I am. When it goes in, it's mine now. I don't care what it is. Good, bad, or indifferent. It now belongs to me, and I don't want to give it back up. I thought of bulimia before, and I'm not kidding, I really have, but I thought that requires throwing up, and I'm not giving it up. I'm just not doing it. So she brought me in. I got sick, and she was very upset. And so it was at least, you know, 2 years before I did that again. But in my childhood, what I found was other substances to take my mind off things that didn't make me throw up, but altered the way that I felt. When I was 11 years old, my older brother, he was 13 months older than me, was hit and killed by a car. And this devastated our family. We didn't know how to deal with it. We didn't have God. You know, I was raised by, I like to say I was raised by a pissed off Catholic. So she still believes that Catholicism is the one true religion. She's just not going to practice it because of them damn people that ruined it. So the priests irritate the hell out of her. She couldn't find one. She was divorced and married a second time. So I was a product of her second marriage, and so she couldn't find a priest that wanted to baptize her children. So for the first 4 years of my life, I wasn't baptized. And you can imagine, if any of you know anything about Catholicism, the hell that woman went through. Because if anything happened to me, if I died, I'd be in baby limbo, and she'd have to spend the rest of her life trying to pray me into heaven. So at 4, she found a priest to baptize me. And I don't know what, I love the Catholic religion. There was a man up there in a black dress speaking in this, you know, flowing, no idea what he was saying, but this flowing voice. I think they did Latin back in them days. It was my first drag show, and I had on this really pretty dress. I was the center of attention. They sprinkled me down with water. It was my first wet t-shirt contest. I won. And the second one, I won. And I was at home. I spent the next 20 years looking for my people. You know, they drank wine. They ate wafers. It was a good day. So my mother, she pulled out of the church. And she was really, you know, angry with that religion. And so we really didn't know a lot about God. Whatever I learned was secondhand, and usually it was the anger. But what I know is in the 12 and 12, it tells me that I have a soul sickness, and I believe that. I believe that because I was not abused by a religion. I wasn't brought up in one. Nobody was telling me that I was going to burn in hell and I was going to die. But when I'd go out in the world and people would say that, I was now abused by your religion, and I was willing to buy into that. And if anybody told me anything good about it, I was not willing to buy into that. So I truly believe that I was born with a soul sickness, that I was born with a disease that one day I would add alcohol to, and it would turn me away from any type of loving God or a God of my understanding. And when I look back on my life today, I can look back and I can cry to you about all these horrible things. I can cry to you about being molested. I can cry to you about the loss of my brother. A year after my brother was killed, on Easter Sunday, I was 12. It was 1 week before my 13th birthday. My father solved his alcoholism by putting a bullet in his head, and I got the call. And I could cry to you, and I can tell you how sad and how horrible that was. Or I can tell you about the 20 years of recovery and how I look back on it and how God gave me everything I ever needed to get through that period. Some people, I look at an 8-year-old child, and I think, my God, I can't imagine a drink in an 8-year-old's hand. I can't imagine a drug in a 10-year-old's hand. I can't imagine, speed and harder drugs in a 13-year-old's hands. But you know what I really can't imagine? How I would have ever gotten through my childhood if I didn't have all those things. So I'm so grateful to God today for looking after me when the adults in my life weren't capable of doing it, that there was something there. You know, so life rocked on, and I learned how to drink. And when I was 13, I do have to show, when I was 13, I met the love of my life. He was really cute. He had brown hair down to here, and he just wasn't like the other boys. In fact, he was so much more like us girls. I thought he was fabulous. Right up until we had sex, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I said, "What, you can't think of anyone else either?" So Brian was 5 years older than me, and it wasn't too long after that that Brian came out, and he was so afraid that I was going to hate him, that I just wasn't going to love him if I found this out about him, and he was just so terrified. And I remember the first time that he came into my house, my mother said to me, "Honey, that boy's gay." And I'm like, "You just stop that, because I love him." And she says, "It's not an insult, sweetheart. It's just a fact of life." So I thought I had this wonderful mother that loved gay people, so it's okay to have gay children. Well, you know, it did become okay, but it didn't start out that way. It's a whole other world when you come in and say, "Mom, guess what?" So what happened is, you know, that we became best friends, and it took me a while. And by the time I was 17 years old, I learned how to drink. And I was hanging out at the bars with Brian. He was taking me in there at 16. And at 16, I'm just hanging out. And the women kind of scared me. And, which, you know, nothing much. I was pretty much a tomboy, and I was pretty much the bully on the playground. Because, you know, where I came from, there was two things that I could do in my mind. One, I could cower and just be the victim and be afraid of everybody. Or two, I could take the biggest one in the room, kick the shit out of him, and not have to worry about the other three. So I decided to kick your ass and feel good about me. And that kind of thing, you know, it helped because that scared little girl inside wasn't being abused anymore. So I spent my life I spent my whole childhood wanting to be an adult and my whole adult life acting like a child. And, you know, because what was modeled to me or what I saw modeled to me, what I remember modeled to me, that being adult was gunning and running and drinking and smoking and fighting. And that's what my family did. And if you came to my house, you did it with us. You know, we wanted everybody to join in. People talk about you weren't allowed to talk about your feelings.
We were. You didn't have a secret. You talked about everything. You know, let's just put something in our body, alter the way our minds were, and let's just share our feelings. Nothing was a damn secret. Now, I can't say that my mother was an alcoholic because my mother says that she was not. I can say that, you know, that she was a weekend warrior and that on her days off, that it was party on and it was always at our house. Now, I can say, because she has said this to me, that she said that she was a sex addict. She goes, I read, you know, I know what my problem was. And I'm like, yeah, I could support you on that one, babe. It's a revolving door. So that's how I learned about relationships, and I learned that monogamy was a color of furniture. So, you know, you got in a relationship, you know, you swore that you would just be with each other and nobody else, and you had sex with other people. So So I got that. And, you know, and so these are the tools I had by the time I reached 17 years old. This is what I had to start, you know, adult life with. And by the time that I was 18 years old, or 17, I came out. I was hanging with Brian out in the bars, and finally got to the place where I wasn't hanging out with Brian anymore. And I want to thank the gay men in the room because you taught me how to walk, talk, and hold my wrists. That was very important when I was at that age. You were safe for me to be around. You didn't want anything out of me. I could be myself. I could have fun. I could be free. You didn't want to have sex with me. That was so wonderful because, you know, it wasn't safe being a girl where I grew up. It wasn't safe at all. And for a long time, I hid in that. I couldn't wear makeup. I couldn't dress. You know, when I first walked in these doors, I would not be up here wearing this today. I'd be in blue jeans. I'd be in a T-shirt. There would be no makeup on. I'd have long hair down to here somewhere. And oh, God, possibly a billfold in my back pocket. Marissa and I talked. We're so relating. It was ugly. Because, I mean, obviously, I'm not the butchest girl in the room. But it was a safe place to be. I also want to thank the gay men in the room of recovery. But because of your love and your willingness to be there for me and not wanting anything out of me, that I was able to be a girl today. And I'm able to dress in pretty clothes, and I'm able to put makeup on, and I'm able to, and it's not a weakness. You know, it's just not. It's who I am today. And I'm a strong woman, and I'm a healthy woman, and a lot of it I owe to you guys. And I still know how to hold my wrist. When I was 18, I got into a relationship with a woman who was 13 years older than me. I don't know who was sicker. What the... I mean, 18-year-olds, yeah, they're really hot, but do you want to live with one? So, one night, we were partying up in Flint, where I was from, and we were living at Whitmore Lake, and we were driving back home, and we were in a Pinto station wagon, which I really think is a lesbian muscle car. And how many of you had one and you was so hot? See, lesbian muscle car, Don and Carrie. So I'm in this Pinto station wagon, and it's in the middle of winter, and it's really, really cold, and I'm really, really drunk. And I'm thinking, if I'm this drunk and I'm still this cold, there's a problem. We should move. She said, well, where would you like to move? And I says, you know, I hear it's warm in Phoenix. That was my decision-making ability back then when I was drinking and very, very young. So 2.5 months later, we were pulling into the desert with our U-Haul. My mother, my brother, and my mother's boyfriend, who had we left 2 years earlier, she would have had to get parental permission to take him out of the state. He and I went to high school together. That's how they met. There was no dysfunction in my family. So we arrive in Phoenix, Arizona, and the first thing I had to do was find a place to live. So we parked the U-Haul, and I found a bar. There was three to choose from. I was so delighted. What I was not delighted about was that the men and the women were very segregated in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, here I am. I'm a gay man in a lesbian body. And I go to Phoenix, and they don't like me. They think I'm a fag hag, and I'm like, well, I am, but I don't want to have sex with you. Really, I don't. Brian, experience, trust me, I don't want to have sex with you. So they were mean to me, so I had to go hang out at those women's bars with those women. It was okay. They all survived me. And I proceeded to drink, and life rocked on, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong. You know, I just couldn't get my finger on it. I was always trying, you know, something different. How would I have any clue that alcohol could be any kind of a problem? Because that's all I ever knew. That's all the people in my family did. The only one they ever talked about being alcoholic in my family was my uncle. My mom's brother was an alcoholic, and we all knew that he was an alcoholic because the police would pull him over and give him tickets and take away his driver's license, so he had paper that said he was an alcoholic. So he would drive when he wasn't supposed to, because he'd get those work furloughs that he's supposed to, and then he'd get drunk and he'd crash his car, and then he'd run home and call the police and say his car was stolen, you know, so he didn't get caught drinking and crashing his car again. And so he was an alcoholic, you know. They didn't call my father an alcoholic. My mother didn't want to talk down to, you know, talk the father of her children, even though they were divorced, to us kids. So what she would always say was, he was irresponsible. Your father was irresponsible. So we were irresponsible people. And I could understand that I was like my dad, and I was a little irresponsible. And I couldn't understand how being a little irresponsible, you know, could be a problem. So it always had to be something else. And so once again, you know, the relationship ends because I don't know, how would I know how to do relationships? You know, I know that I show up, I take a hostage, and, you know, I don't want you to leave or anything, because if God forbid, should somebody not be there to take care of stuff. But, you know, when I'm over you, let's not break up or anything. I'll just have sex with other people. That'll be okay, because it's, you know, the furniture color. We're having, you know, a monogamous relationship. It's all right. I just, you know, we don't bring them home or anything like that. But you still take care of me. And then they, of course, who's going to put up with that? So relationships would end and they'd come and go. And so when I was 23, I decided that, you know, that Arizona's just a bad place. It's almost as bad as Michigan. And really, it would probably be better. My friend Brian was living out in California. It'd probably be better if I just went to Northern California and lived there, because there's no drugs or alcohol in Northern California. Don't we have a Bay Area person? Am I right? Yeah. Am I right? There's no nothing going on there, is there? Uh-uh. We're good there. That's what I thought. I'm an intelligent woman. I won't drink and I won't drug. It'll be okay. I'll get better there. You know, I'll be able to, I didn't want to quit drinking. I just wanted to rein this in. I wanted it to be fun. That was my whole goal in life. When I hear people come up here and speak and say, I never enjoyed my drinking, my heart goes out to you. It does. Because I would hate to think I did something over a 20-year span and never enjoyed it once. You know, I did. I loved drinking. I loved everything about it. I loved the bar. I loved the people in it. I had a blast. I would walk in, the smell, the sounds, the sights. If you knew the words to every song that played on that slide tonight, you came out when I did. You were in the bars when I was hanging out there. I was getting ready to grab me a gay man and get up and disco dance. You know, and I see the little balls that we're wearing around our neck. I couldn't quite put one of those on. It wouldn't really go with my outfit. So it was in the basket. It was lovely, but I was ready to start ducking under Marissa there and dancing. She's wearing the disco ball. But those were the songs that were playing when I was coming out into the bars, and I loved it. I loved it. You know, the first speaker I ever heard talked about being sober for 25 years, and I thought, and you're bragging? I wanted to take her out and buy her a drink. She sounded to me like she needed one. I said, I spent 6 months at State Bar and never missed a night. Now, there's bragging rights. You ever been to a gay bar hole in the wall on a Monday night with the prostitutes? You haven't lived. By the time I was 17 years old, I saw everything you could possibly see done in public in that bar. I watched a man bend himself in half one time, and we won't talk about what he did. But I got up there on the stage to make sure I was seeing what I thought I was seeing, and I was. And I told him that was very impressive. We had a 50-year-old woman who, every time she would get drunk, I laughed about it then, but today I don't, because today I understand the disease of alcoholism. But she would get drunk, and by the time, you know, she got to a certain point in her drinking, she'd start stripping. And she'd had a mastectomy on one side, and she was in her 50s, and she just, maybe 20 years ago could have taken her clothes off in public, but yeah, you know, and we'd all laugh and, and make fun, and she's up there and she's stripping her clothes off, and today it breaks my heart because I know the disease of alcoholism, and I know the places that it takes us, and I know where it took me, and that's the woman I became. I became the person that would walk into the room and pull the shirt off to shock you, and didn't, you know, everybody say, oh, Laura, she don't care, she'll, you know, she'll do this or she'll do that, and it was true, I would, because I didn't have any self-respect or self-esteem or self-love. I didn't have these things. And I drank to hide the pain, and I drank to have fun, and then I would do all those behaviors all over again, and then I would have to drink to hide the pain, and then I would have to drink to have fun, and it was a vicious damn cycle, and I had no idea. No idea that it was something called alcoholism. No idea. So I moved to California to be with Brian, my best friend, and I figured that I would be okay there. And I came into town, and of course I arrive, and I'm taking speed all day because I got to stay awake for 12, 13 hours while I do this drive. You know, and then I have to have something to drink because, you know, you get a little cotton mouth, you know, so I'm, so, and then you want something to drink that tastes good that'll keep you, you know, your mind busy because that's a long drive by yourself. So I had everything packed up in my little truck. Yeah, I even had a truck then. It was a little dachshund thing. It was really, really cute. So it was a cute, like, little cute lesbian girl truck, not one of those big butch ones like my girlfriend got some years ago. Like the kind of women I love to marry. So... and so I arrived into town. Brian and I hadn't seen him in 4 years, and it was as if all that had melted away, and I was with my best friend again, and it was party on, and it was a good time. And so I had to get a job, and because you know what I learned? That I always, you know, I suffered from financial insecurity, you know, and the promises say that we get, you know, that we lose that. I didn't know I suffered from financial insecurity. All I knew was this, is that you were a very poor source to get my alcohol from. You were very unreliable. And so I had to have some kind of a job so I could at least pay for what I drank. You could obviously supply me with a car and a roof over my head and all those other things, possibly food, you know, but you just weren't good about keeping me in my alcohol, so I had to have a job for at least that. So I went out and I got a job, and I began working at this place, and there was a woman there that had something I wanted. It had nothing to do with recovery, but I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. So we got to talking, and she told me that she used to do a lot of cocaine, that she had a real problem with it, and that she went to this program because of this cocaine that she did, and that she knew that she couldn't drink, so she also, because it would lead her back to her drug of choice, and so she also went to AA. Now, I'd never heard of AA, and I'm like, okay. That's cool. I can support you. I can help you. I help people. That's what I do. So I thought, you know, this is great. So our first date, she takes me to an AA meeting. Who the hell takes anyone to an AA meeting on their first date? And it was a speaker meeting, and it was a room like this and about this many people in it, and I was sitting about there in the middle, and that's where I heard that woman who was bragging about not having a drink for 25 years. Like, who'd brag about such a thing? And she talked about being going to jail, and she talked about being in institutions, and she talked about being hospitalized, and she talked about getting DUIs, and all these things that had never happened to me. And I thought, wow, all that going on, and you don't want a drink? That's why I wanted to buy her a drink. I thought, you know, I bet it could help. I'm sure it could. And then this really weird thing happened. She started talking about this big hole that was inside of her that just couldn't be filled up no matter how much alcohol or how many drugs that she put into her system, and no matter how many relationships that she got into, and no matter how much she ate or no matter what she did, that hole was still there. And that she came into these rooms and she began working some steps, these things that were on the wall, and that they changed her life. And that she found something, you know, outside of herself. She talked about having low self-esteem, no self-love, and no self-respect. And I thought it was a setup. I thought, how did this woman know? How did she know to bring me into this room? How did she know? And why is that woman, when there's all these people in the room looking just at me, how is that happening? And I heard something that night, and I was 24 years old. And I thought, wow, maybe there might be a problem here. And so I saw that gal a couple of more times, and that was over. And I ended up staying in Alcoholics Anonymous for 4.5 months. But I wasn't done. I wasn't there for me. It was a wonderful thing. I got that book y'all talked about. I read it cover to cover. I love the stories in the back. They were fabulous. I love a good story. So I enjoyed those very much. I asked this woman if she would sponsor me. She had a lot of time, and she looked kind of strange, but there was something interesting about her. And the first thing she said to me was, "I don't even know you." I said, "Well, what they keep saying here is you didn't have to." I thought, "Oh, you're degrading me, and you're not very nice. You should probably be my sponsor because that's all I'm worth." And I hung out with her for about 4.5 months, and I was alone. I was out of a relationship. I didn't have anything to drink. I was living with people that drank and drugged and had all my favorite drugs, and I was really having a hard time with this God thing that they were talking about, and I just couldn't even get it. I thought, there's just no way. You know, God doesn't love me. Look at all the things. Look at all the horrible things. You know, he let me be molested when I was little. He killed my brother. He killed my dad. You know, he just all these horrible things, and look at, you know, all the violence in my house growing up. There's no loving God. I couldn't believe any of that. I just could not see any of that. And so my Brian's partner's sister was coming down, and she kept coming down and to visit and stuff, and she was supposedly straight, and I'd heard the warning about them. They came with warning labels. Straight women came with warning labels, and I saw her warning label, and they said, Brian kept saying, "I don't really think she is." And I said, "I think she's coming down to see you." And I'm like, "No, I don't think so, I don't think so, I don't think so." And then finally it was, "Well, maybe I think so." And it was Super Bowl Sunday. She was coming down for the weekend, and things were starting to happen between us. And I asked her, I said, "Well, if you come down," I said, "could you please not drink? Could we not drink, you know, this one day?" And so everybody in the house agreed. And by noon, everybody in the house was drinking and doing their preferred drug. And, you know, and I knew if I was going to be in this relationship that I was probably going to have to drink. Now, I'm going to back up a minute here, because when I was 2 months sober at this, another thing you might have told me but I didn't hear, you might have told me that that there was a thing called detoxing. And that what happens with detoxing is that the brain, you know, is suddenly without its drug, and there's chemicals that are created from drinking that happens in the alcoholic mind that causes the obsession of mind. The craving doesn't start until you put the drug into your body. But the obsession of mind. And when you take that away and your body suddenly doesn't have it, that sometimes you can't sleep very well. Or sometimes when you finally get to sleep, you don't wake up very well. Or sometimes when you're really, really happy, you just start crying. And if you're like me, crying is not acceptable. It just is not acceptable, because crying is a sign of weakness. And if you're weak, people will get you. You do not let them see a weakness. So I'm driving home one night from work, and I'm singing some rock and rolls on, and it's a happy song, and I'm singing, and all of a sudden I'm crying, and tears are running down my face, and it's uncontrollable, and I don't know what's going on with me, and I'm like, I know what can fix this. I know what can stop this. And so I went to a drive-thru liquor, and I brought some blackberry brandy. Why? I'm a beer drinker. I do shots. I don't know about blackberry brandy, but that's what I bought. And so I bought some blackberry brandy. I brought it home, and I got dressed up. And this was one of the times where I, you know, put a little makeup on, and because you know I hadn't drank in a while, and so I put a little makeup on, and I got dressed up, and I took the bottle in my truck, and we went on a date, and we went to the Bay Area. We drove around all three bridges. I held it in my hand, and I talked to it. I uncapped it, and I sniffed it, and I put the cap back on. Because you guys told me I couldn't drink. You didn't tell me I couldn't buy alcohol and drive it around the Bay Area. You told me I couldn't drink it. And I would set it next to me, in the seat next to me, and I'd turn music on, and we'd sing. And we'd talk, and we'd cry, and we'd laugh, and I'd put the bottle between my legs, and then I would set it, you know? And I went home that night, and I put that bottle under my pillow, and I went to sleep, and I never thought there was anything sick about that. Nothing wrong with that. Well, when I got up the next morning, there's something under my head, and I'm like, what the hell? And my bottle of blackberry brandy. Well, I didn't know what to do with her, so I put her in the freezer. So that's Super Bowl Sunday. That's what I went and grabbed, and that's what I drank, and I drank for the next 3.5 years. And I had to drink to be in that relationship. It was the most abusive relationship. I would love to blame it all on her. I would like to say that, you know, that it was all her fault. But what happened is there was two very sick people in a very sick relationship. And after 2 years in California, we lost everything, of course, and I just couldn't maintain. And I was staying at some people's house, and in Napa Valley, I don't even remember their names, Jim. I remember him. I remember him because it was actually his apartment, and it was his booze I was drinking, and sometimes he'd bring home cocaine. I loved him. And he had some straight woman who was pregnant living at his place. So here he's got these women living off him. Why? I don't know. You know, I think he could use a little 12-step program himself, a gay man, and he's got women living off him. And so she and I are, you know, I'm still seeing her. She lives in Napa Valley with her father. I'm staying with these people. I don't even know. I've been evicted out of the apartment. Brian and I lied our ways into apartment managers. We told them how, yeah, we're married and we've been doing this for years. And we made up, him and I could make up some crazy shit. He was so much fun. We could make up some stories. And so we told these people, I mean, we presented ourselves as this straight married couple and how we, you know, manage apartments and, you know, we've done new ones before. Yes, we filled them up. Well, this is how it went, okay? This is how it went. I'm sitting in an apartment by myself drinking with the one person on earth I don't like. I'm a bar drinker. I don't drink alone for a reason. I understand people also drink solitarily. I didn't do it very well because I didn't like the company. And that's the truth. And if I was alone with me long enough, you know, I would want to die. I would wonder. I'd think about my father, and I would think, how drunk do you got to get? How drunk do you got to get to pull that trigger? How drunk do you got to get? And so I'm sitting there with me, and people are putting in their applications, and nobody's good enough to live in my apartments. And I check your credit, and it wasn't good enough. I had four buildings I needed to fill up. I rented three. And like 3 months. And that was it. The rest of you weren't good enough and you weren't living in any of my apartments. Then I started hanging out in Napa Valley because I just couldn't sit there in that house, you know, all by myself drinking one more day. So I got fired. And they wanted to evict me, but I had the keys. So every place in there had the electricity turned off, and they shut the electricity off in my place, so I ran an extension cord to the house next door so I at least had a light bulb, and I could change. And, you know, and I'm hanging out in Napa Valley. Everything I own is locked up, and they finally locked me out. It's locked up in this apartment. Brian's staying over at his, you know, wherever his boyfriend, Connie's. Yeah, and that's what was really cute, too. Brian and I got married in a mess of all of this. I don't know why. He was going to put me on his insurance. He was my best friend, and it was kind of this little security thing, but none of that happened. You know, what it was, my mom came out. We had this really wonderful wedding, and he went to bed, and my mother and I stayed up and gambled all night, and, you know, and came back. We were Mr. and Mrs. And we lived with his brother and sister. You know, Brian was with the guy, and I was with his sister, and this was our family unit. And there's none sit going on here. So, yeah. Isn't that shit crazy? I did not think so. Did not think so. There's no problem here. There's no problem still. So I find myself living with these people, and I get in a fight with this with the girlfriend at the time, and I said, well, I'm going home. And I walk out. And that's honest to God, it's the first time I realized I didn't have a home. And I'm like, wow, I hope she comes and gets me soon. And I'm walking down the street, and I don't have a car. I've lost everything. I've got nothing. I'm walking home, and I've got nothing. So I end up, long story short, it took me 4 days to get home, and it took me 3 years to get sober. And I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at 28 years old, and you'd have thought that I was 48 years old because I was beat to hell. I was beat to hell by this disease, by my behavior, by the relationships, by everything in here, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And I walked in these rooms, and I wished I could tell you that I walked in here and got a God of my understanding, and that I worked, you know, which I did. I did finally work these steps, and everything was just wonderful from then out, but that wasn't my story. I got into these rooms, and I was beat up, but I was just, you know, just enough to ask for help. Just enough to ask for help. At 7 months sober,
I was taking care of Brian. He was he'd been diagnosed with HIV, and it soon turned to AIDS. And at 7 months sober, I held his hand when he took his last breath. And it was because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to do that. Because when he told me he was sick, you know what the first thing I did? I cried, not for him, but for me. Because what am I going to do without my friend if he dies? That's sad. You know, on my best day, I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief when I wake up in the morning. And Alcoholics Anonymous, one day at a time, has taught me how to not be a liar, not be a cheat, and not be a thief. I got in here with the first step that I could understand that I'm an alcoholic. I could finally get that. Couldn't quite get the unmanageability because you guys were talking about all the stuff you lost. It took me a little while to realize, Lori, you got to get stuff to lose it. I didn't lose anything because I never had anything. If I had anything, it was because I took it from you. Your stuff would become my stuff. Relationships were wonderful that way. So, you know, I got step one. Step two, it was difficult. How am I going to get that God thing? Because God was my enemy. He was out to get me. It was just bad, bad, bad. How am I going to get that God thing? And when I lost Brian, I was able, believe it or not, to get that God thing. Because, you see, I knew I couldn't ask that Brian get well. I knew that wasn't going to happen. I knew that I was going to lose my best friend. So I said, God, please, let me take care of him. Let me be there for him. Let me let this man know that one person on earth loves him unconditionally. I lived with him for 30 days in San Francisco up in a hospital. And I had nobody to talk to. I made it to one meeting. I was 3 months sober. And I made it to one meeting in that time. And I talked to God every single night. Because there were so many days he was so sick, he couldn't visit. And I just sat there. And I took him off these diapers that they had him on. And I gave him his dignity back. And I cleaned him up. And he was so ashamed. And I said, Brian, it's me. It's not some stranger off the street. It is me. And it is okay. And I love you. And they bragged about what good care I took of him. His skin never broke down. He laid on his back for 8 weeks and never had a bed sore because I took care of him. I didn't do that. I'm a selfish human being. I will steal from you. I will lie to you. And I will cheat on you. Give me a minute. 1 minute. And these are the things I'll do to you because this is what I learned to do. But I spent that time with that man and I took care of him. And I learned that there was a God in my understanding. Because at 7 months sober, I brought Brian back to my home in Phoenix. And I held his hand when he took his last breath and he was at peace. And he knew somebody loved him unconditionally. And you guys gave me that ability. And I cried and I never thought I'd stop. My heart broke that day. But I knew there was a God there with me. And that I knew something. And I want the new people in the room, I want you to know this. I don't care what's going on in your life. I don't care if your father blows his brains. I don't care if your brother dies. And I don't care if your best friend dies in your arms. You do not have to drink or drug anymore. Yeah. November 19th, 1990. One of my best drinking buddies came back into town just a few months previous to that, and she was sober, and I wasn't happy about it. It was like the story of Bill Wilson. I was so glad my friend was coming to town. I could drink unreservedly, and she was sober. I was not happy. But she needed a place to stay, and I'm just a giver. So I moved her into my house, and on November 19th, 1990, I got up one morning. And, you know, I wished I could say that I'd tell you this great story about a last drunk or whatever, but you know what it was? You know what my last drink was? A wine cooler on a Sunday night. Oh, my God. What was all my mom had in her fridge, for God's sakes, people? I might have had two. But a miracle happened that night. Two things. One, the phenomenon of craving did not set in, and that's the first time in several years that I put a drop of alcohol into my system and the phenomenon of craving did not set in. Two, I had a moment of clarity. I realized that I couldn't do this anymore and that there was another way out, and I'd learned about it 3.5 years previously, and I had a very good friend who was staying at my house and was willing to help me. So the next morning I got up and I called into work, and I was taking the last day off that I could possibly take off because I was about to lose my job due to my drinking, and she took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I lost Brian at that 7 months and I realized I could do a little bit of this God thing, I got a sponsor, I hit my knees and we took the third step together. And I wrote out the best 4-step I could possibly write in my life.
It was the best that I could do at that time. And I wrote down how all you guys people had been pissing me off since I was 4 years old. And I wrote about all of you. And then I turned the page. And I said, what? My part? And I took an honest look and I put my part down. And I read this out to another human being. And like Carrie said, she didn't go run screaming out of the room. In fact, she cleaned her pool and was kind of bored. I thought she should have been more impressed. And she gave me the book and she sent me home. She goes, I want you to spend an hour. And I thought, doing what? So I sat there an hour. Okay. And then I hit my knees and I said that seven-step prayer, and that was the best that I could do, six and seven, for the first time through. And I wrote a list of people that I had hurt. And she taught me how to go and make amends to them all. Back then, I thought amends meant saying I'm sorry. And what have I got? How much time have I got? When am I supposed to be done? Should I be done? Should I have quit by now? Oh, son of a bitch, and I haven't even gotten sober. We've been a drunkalog all this time. I apologize. Step one's the problem. Step two is the solution. Step three is inviting the solution into your life. Step four is taking a look at the mess that you've made because you didn't have a solution. Step six are the character assets that went awry, became defects, and caused that mess. Seven, saying, God, please, take them. Eight is making a list of the people you hurt because of all that stuff that went on in that fourth step and because of those characters. Nine is cleaning it up. It's not just saying I'm sorry, it's cleaning it up. To amend is to fix, to repair, to change. And it's to change a behavior. Sometimes it's just changing a behavior. Sometimes the best we can do is change a behavior. It's changing that behavior. 10 is paying attention, because you know what? Just because I did 1 through 9 doesn't mean I'm better or well. Now I just know about it and I got to pay attention to it. Promptly for me sometimes means a week because, all right, I admit it, I did it. You know? And I got to clean it up. 11 is prayer and meditation, a conscious contact with God, a loving God of my understanding that's going to help me solve my problem. 12 is carrying the message to other people. 12 is doing service. 12 is giving it away. 12 is doing it even when you don't want to do it. And most of the time I don't, because I'm a selfish human being. And so thank you so much for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And I'll...